This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by the Carnivore Club. The Carnivore Club is a subscription service that brings exceptional quality cured meats to your door made by America's most talented artisans. That's right, meat delivered directly to your door. It's an amazing gift for the people in your life. You can there's different ways you can customize this. So if you just want to send a box 1 month to one of your friends, you can do that. Or if you really want to like make someone's year, you sign up for a monthly subscription for them, and each month they're going to get a different lineup of cured meats sent to your door. In this month's box, the featured meat is California's Angel Salumi. Really good, really tasty. And right now, you can get $10 off a gift or subscription when you enter the promo code AOM at checkout. So visit carnivoreclub.co to give the best gift to the discerning meat lover of your life and use AOM at checkout for $10 off your gift or subscription. Also buy Cricut shirts. Guys, it's starting to cool down around here. It's finally fall here in Oklahoma, so I'm busting out the sweaters and long sleeve shirts. And one of the sweaters that I'm wearing right now is one from Cricut Shirts. So they're the makers of my favorite polo shirt, the Players Polo. But besides that, they've got some really nice sweaters and long sleeve shirts. For example, they have some great V-neck sweaters that are great for layering. They also have a long sleeve version of their Players Polo. So the collar looks exactly the same. You got the pocket that like you have on the Players Polo, just a longer sleeve. And besides that, they have some nice button-down shirts that look great for like office casual. So if you want to try them out and get a discount on your first order, go to cricutshirts.com and use coupon code ARTOFMAN at checkout, that's all one word, for 20% off. Again, that's Cricut Shirts, CRICUETSHIRTS.com, discount code ARTOFMAN at checkout for 20% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, if you enjoy shows like The Wire or True Detective or Law and Order, or if you enjoy film noir, there's one guy you can thank for that. His name is Dashiell Hammett, and he was a writer during the 1920s and 30s and through the 40s, and he is the guy who created the modern detective. He was the man who created one of the most iconic masculine anti-heroes, Sam Spade, who started off in a book, later became a movie hero, played by Humphrey Bogart and the Maltese Falcon. But Dashiell Hammett, he took the detective genre and brought it into the modern era. And the reason he was able to do that was that he himself was a detective before he became a writer. He was a private eye for the Pinkerton Detective Agency in his early days. And a lot of the stories that he published and wrote were inspired by his own experience or the experiences of other PIs that he knew and about. But the thing is, there's not that much out there about Dashiell Hammett's time as a Pinkerton detective. So my guest today, he wanted to find out all about his career and what made Dashiell Hammett Dashiell Hammett. And his name's Nathan Ward. He wrote a book called The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett. And I had to get him on the podcast because I'm a huge Dashiell Hammett fan. I'm a huge detective novel fan from that time, Raymond Chandler, all those guys. And today on the podcast, we're going to discuss how Dashiell, we'll talk about that, how you pronounce his name in a bit, became Dashiell Hammett and how his experience as a Pinkerton detective paved the way for the modern American detective novel and modern America detective television and cinema. If you love this sort of thing, this genre of literature and movies or cinema, you're going to love this podcast. So without further ado, Nathan Ward, The Lost Detective. All right. Hey, Nathan Ward, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, your book is about, it's called The Lost Detective. It's a biography of Dashiell Hammett. And we just were having this interesting conversation before we got on here on how do you pronounce this? So I always pronounce it Dashiell, but there's controversy about that.
Well, it's not controversy so much as like the family says Dashiell. He said Dashiell. It's originally a French name, the Dashiells who came over in the 18th century. on his mother's side, but I just grew up saying Dashiell, saying it the wrong way, and so I, you know, when I remember to, if there's, you know, if his family's in the audience, I'll say Dashiell, but I normally I just say Dashiell like everyone else.
All right, so okay, I'm going to say Dashiell too. I was like going into this thing.
That's fine. We can dumb it down.
All right, I like that. I like your style. All right, so Dashiell Hammett is one of the most influential American writers, but a lot of people don't know who he is, but they probably know who his creations are. For example, Sam Spade, you know, he wrote The Maltese Falcon, introduced Sam Spade to the American icons of American masculinity, The Thin Man. But the thing is, he's really highly influential, but there's not that much out there about Dashiell Hammett's life. Why is that?
Well, there are several full biographies, one of which, the official one by Diane Johnson, was, you know, commissioned by Lillian Hellman, his longtime companion. And in that book, which is the longest one, there was an agreement that Lillian Hellman herself had to appear pretty early in the book. So poor Diane Johnson had to get him to his early 30s, where he met Lillian Hellman, in order for their life together to take, you know, the rest of the book. And so there's a very, very good book by Richard Layman that does his whole life, but these are like, they're like, I compare it to cross-country trains, and his early life as a detective is just like one stop where you could get off, and that's what I chose to do, is to really immerse myself in this early period of his life and see if there was anything still to be found out about what kind of detective he really was, because that was part of his authenticity, was that he had been an actual Pinkerton detective before he became the consummate detective writer.
Well, that's what separates him from all the other ones, right? None of the other really famous detective novelists weren't detectives themselves. I'm talking like Raymond Chandler or any of those other guys.
That's right. But, I mean, it helps that those guys, I mean, he wrote better than most of them, too. I mean, you wouldn't have heard of him if he was just a Pinkerton who tried writing about his Pinkerton adventures and he couldn't write. You know, it's the talent was there from somewhere else.
Yeah. So let's talk about this Pinkerton agency, because this is something that you've heard about the Pinkertons. Talk about them in, you hear about them in when you study like labor unions and things like that in school. And I remember the Pinkertons showed up in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but I didn't know much about what they did. Why did the Pinkerton detective agency exist? I mean, it seems like they took on cases that law enforcement should have done, but why was it that Pinkerton that did this?
Well, it wouldn't have been able to grow as it did in Europe. Alan Pinkerton was a Scottish immigrant. He came over here. He was a barrel maker. And one day he solved a smuggling ring. I mean, broke a smuggling ring in Illinois. And the local merchants then tried to hire him to solve other cases. And he eventually chucked his barrel making business for starting his own agency. He was the first American detective agency, and it grew because you had all these emerging towns around, you know, rural America, and one of the last things you can add is a real police department. You might have a sheriff, you might have a marshal who visits sometimes, but you don't have a full police department, as we now understand it, so the Pinkertons would be hired to come to your town, take care of this gang that was bothering the local businesses, and they could follow them over city or state lines in a way that a local agency could not. And that was one of the, once the towns along the West had established. Had grown up a little bit. They didn't need the Pinkertons as much for that kind of stuff, and the Pinkertons got into railroad work. They would put a guy in your the cafe car of your train, and watch for pilferage among the employees. And they got into, that's when they got into more of the labor stuff. They would insert a guy secretly onto the strike committee at your factory and tell you what the plans were for the strike, you know, day by day. And then increasingly, that's where they followed the money, and that's where it got was in the big corporate accounts like that, strike breaking, the ugly World War One era stuff that people associate with the Pinkertons now. People usually know that the strike breaking era stuff, or they know it from Butch Cassidy, but the earlier. The earlier rural kind of cases are less familiar. And it was fun to go read through the Pinkerton archives, and you know they just have all the op reports that they wanted you to see from the 19th century. You can see them, all the outlaw cases, all the bank robber cases, and that kind of stuff. It's enormously fun to read.
Yeah, and why did the Pinkertons go away? Was it because the FBI, like national,
that didn't exist yet?
And yeah, that's it didn't right. exist, but is that kind of what contributed to its demise?
Well, they didn't go away. They're sort of I think they're owned by a Swedish company now, and they just do sort of security work, international corporate security work.
Gotcha.
And they don't answer letters from scholars. That's the two things I know about them.
You learned that, okay.
They've never acknowledged that Hammett worked for them, and his actual reports that he would have written as an operative have never emerged anywhere. And I mean, they were written under aliases. I mean, not aliases, you know, you would be op number 7 or op number 20 or, you know, and I, my theory is, I mean, it's, if it wasn't a fire, which is what people always say when something disappears, I think that, the client was the owner of these reports, especially in your delicate labor cases. And I'm sure that if he did that kind of work, my secret hope is that his reports are in some corporate archive somewhere and nobody knows who wrote them. But they wouldn't be still with the Pinkertons. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Gotcha.
They would be the client.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you weren't able to like access the reports that Hammett wrote, or, and the Pinkertons disavow that Hammett ever worked for him, how did you research this book?
Well, they won't say one way or the other. They just won't confirm it. I don't know legally why that's to their advantage, but they just have left it. I guess they can't prove it one way or the other. That's maybe why. Yeah. I mean, the papers from the specific offices that he worked at, the Baltimore office, the Spokane office, the Seattle office, and the San Francisco office, those are not among the collected papers in the National Archives that they donated. So it is very hard to, prove certain things that he said.
Yeah, so how did you, what was the research involved? I mean, how did you figure out that he worked in certain places? Was it just diary entries, letters that Hammett wrote? What was your research process like for
this book? Well, there were letters, but he didn't save his letters the way you would want him to. He moved a lot in his life, and he lived in a lot of hotels, and he pitched them, you know? So there's letters. If someone kept the letters he wrote, then that's great. And there was a book of his letters that, you know, his wife kept and various girlfriends kept. And that's good. But you don't get a lot of correspondence back and forth. The surest way I had of knowing where he lived when was his Army medical file. Because he got tuberculosis in the Army, a nurse would have to come by and give him an examination every few months to determine the amount of disability he should get. So sometimes he's 40% disabled, and sometimes he's 60% disabled. So that, you know, you could see his health go up and down throughout the 20s. And you'd know that he was getting less money when he was healthier, and more money when he was near death. and you could sort of track, well, if he claimed to have worked a certain very physical case, you could say, well, how could he have climbed the mast of a ship and found and recovered the stolen gold if he was, you know, 60% disabled and tubercular? And so that I would get little, indications of what was possible when. But I have to say, he showed up at a lot of jobs for a guy who should have just been in bed for, you know, months and months at a time. I mean, he was really impressive the way he just kept trying to earn money for his family.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, guys, fall is here, winter's coming, and one of the things you can add to your wardrobe to really make it versatile and look really sharp is a pair of nice dress boots. But the problem with dress boots is that they can get really expensive really fast. We're talking $300, $400, $500 for a pair. It's out of the price range of most average guys. That's where Thursday Boots come in. They make a quality boot from some of the best leather from Tier 1 Grade A USA cattle, Goodyear Welt Construction. They have a glove leather interior lining. And they have different types of boots. They have like a traditional dress boot. They also have a chukka boot, which I have, and I've been wearing it a lot lately. They're really comfortable and they look great. Great for a casual office look, right? And best of all, with Thursday Boots, it's affordable. Prices start at $149 and it's free shipping and returns. So if you want to see some of my favorite boots at Thursday Boots, go to thursdayboots.com/AOM to see a selection of my favorites. Thursday Boots, perfect for work and play. And guys, if you haven't already, there's another podcast I'd recommend you check out if you like The Art of Manliness. It's The Art of Charm podcast hosted by Jordan and AJ Harbinger. They bring on guests from a wide variety of fields, psychologists, academics, entrepreneurs, personal finance experts, and just basically try to get the most practical information from them. A while back ago, I talked to Jordan about an episode he did with a guy named Todd Herman on the power of negative thinking. Listen in. Okay, hey, Jordan, so tell me a little about this guest you had on. The episode name really intrigued me, The Power of Negative Thinking, Todd Herman. What did you guys discuss?
Sure. Todd Herman is a really interesting guy as well. He's a friend of mine, and I didn't know this right off the bat. I just thought he was a cool guy, but it turns out he's a really high-end coach to people that you see on television, that you buy things from even when you don't know you're buying things from them. And he teaches them how to not only be better high performers and get more things done, but also the type of mindset that you need to get ahead, to stay ahead, to stay not only motivated, but stay sharp over time. And it's pretty fascinating thinking about how somebody who is your age or my age or slightly older can really be a superstar in an industry that's extremely competitive. And so learning a lot from Todd Herman is interesting because you'd not only learn about why 90-day goals are useless and things like that, or goals beyond 90 days are useless or whatever, this goal-setting myths, but you also kind of get an example that lights a fire under your butt about how, you know, you and I can step it up too. And he gives concrete examples of that too. So it's an inspiring episode, again, with very practical application, which is what we strive for at AOC.
And you can find that episode and more episodes like it at theartofcharm.com or search for The Art of Charm on iTunes or Stitcher. Yeah, that's what surprised me the most. Because, you know, when I imagined, okay, he's a Pinkerton detective, I thought, okay, he's going to be this big, kind of burly, you know, Humphrey Bogart type guy. But he was actually not. I mean, yeah, like you said, he had tuberculosis, and then he was actually pretty small. I think he weighed 130 pounds or something like that.
When he was sick, he was 130 pounds.
Yeah.
He should have been 150, 160. He was, you know, 6 feet plus, but rail thin, as they say.
Yeah. So, I mean, how long did he work at the Pinkertons? What's the time frame we're talking here?
Well, he started when he was 21 in 1915, and it's not a, you know, he didn't work straight through 1922. He did a couple of years, then he entered the army right at the end of World War One, the end of 1917. And then he got the tuberculosis in the army. First he got the influenza, and then that weakened him, and he was in this, army hospital where all the cots were about 2 feet apart from each other, and so he easily caught tuberculosis in there. And then he went back to part-time Pinkerton work in the Northwest. And then he went to a hospital for cases, for TB cases. And that's where he met his wife, who was his nurse. Then he moved to San Francisco. And he, once he learned by letter that she was pregnant, he asked her to come join him and get married in San Francisco. And then that's where that was his last, that's 1921, the fall of 1921. So the most influential part of his life would be the 6 to 8 months he worked as a part-time Pinkerton in San Francisco. That's where he learned the town. That's where he created his first stories, the Continental Op stories, and that's where ultimately he created Sam Spade, and who lived in the apartment that he was living in as he wrote it.
Yeah. So I mean, do we know anything about the type of work or missions, I guess, quote unquote mission, we'll call them mission jobs he got? Like you mentioned he said that he found the gold on top of a mast. Are we pretty safe to say that was a lot of fabrication? He was embellishing the truth?
Oh yeah, people loved these stories. Later when he was known as an ex-detective, the stories just got better and better because he would be surrounded by literary people who hadn't done anything like that, and he would just be so, they would eat it up. And of course it helped, solidify his legend, if that's possible as a verb, and made him even more authentic. And he liked telling stories. That's what he fundamentally is. He's a great, great storyteller. There's a school of thought that he has to have been the greatest detective ever in order to be as great a detective writer as he became. And I don't believe that's true. I think you have to have learned enough to exploit it masterfully, which he did. He doesn't have to have been the greatest detective of all time, but I think he was a pretty good one, and he was a very observant person. And it was the first job he had had that rewarded being an observant person. He was fired from a whole lot of menial jobs before he entered the Pinkertons, and it was the first one that stuck. Then he got tuberculosis, and once he finally was too sick to even get to the office anymore, he started sending out stories to make money. The way I know that is because the nurses that visited him would file reports. First of all, that's how you know where he was living at certain months. And at one point, he bragged to the nurse that was visiting him that he was making some extra money as a short story writer. And, I don't think it was in his interest to say that because, you want her to say that you should get the maximum disability, right? So he obviously was so giddy about his new success that he told her about it, and so there you could exactly date, when he was writing what, and so on. It was if I didn't have the Army medical file, I really don't know how I could have done this book.
Yeah,
so many gaps in his life, and it's sort of like the biography of his illness.
So how did he decide writing? Was it just like, is the only thing I can do in bed in my house? Was that was it sort of necessity that he decided on that? Or he had an inclination for storytelling and that's what drew him to that?
Well, I mean, I think he was a good storyteller in general. There's no evidence before he entered the Pinkertons that he wanted to be a writer. I think he had a mother who told him he could be whatever he wanted, which helps. But I don't think she told him what he should be in particular. Always was a big reader, and I think the most true quote that is ascribed to him is he came back from the San Francisco Public Library having read a bunch of pulp magazines in the reading room there. And he said, sort of contemptuously, "I could do that." and it, meaning also that he would know what he was talking about, unlike the people who were writing those fanciful detection stories. And it turned out that he could.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about these pulp magazines in a bit here, because it's really, I think it's a lost, forgotten part of American literary history, or overlooked. But talk about, like, what, how did his experience as a Pinkerton help him as a writer? And I'm not just talking about he was able to get, he had this experiences that he could call upon to help his stories, but you even make the case in the book that the reports he had to write as a Pinkerton op helped him develop the style of writing that he became famous for.
Yes, once I learned more about how the Pinkerton agency actually functioned, like once you learned where people would be assigned from around the country for particular cases, and what kind of jobs your average op would be assigned to do, I got to reading the op reports of the other operatives, the ones that are surviving, and there really was a certain literary style, house style, starting with not being judgmental in writing about, these street guys and rogues that they had to be interested in to solve these crimes. And the whole point of Alan Pinkerton's approach, as opposed to, say, you know, the Sherlock Holmes approach, was assimilation with criminals. And there is no better way to learn what he learned than having to pass yourself off among rough types. And the discipline of writing up what you see every day for not just the client, but the supervisors who would sometimes edit what you had written to the client's liking, that experience, I saw it as like a newspaper. And I compared him to Ernest Hemingway at the same time working at the Kansas City Star. Those two institutions did not teach those guys how to write. I mean, they came there with their gift, but it was a place where their observing power and lyrical ability was rewarded day after day, and it could only have increased their confidence in what they were doing. So that's how I looked at it, as opposed to the old way of trying to account for his style was, you know, these English professors would strain themselves trying to prove that he must have read this Hemingway story in the public library in 1923, and then that excited his imagination into writing short clipped street dialogue. You know, I mean, there was a certain amount of it that was in the air in America in general, because people wanted to sound wised up because they'd been to the war, and the war made people more cynical. But I don't see it just coming from reading, although he'd read a lot. I think it was this experience as a Pinkerton op that really honed him.
So how did are there any specific real experiences that he had as a Pinkerton op that ended up in some of the stories that he wrote?
Well, let's see. There are two things that come up again and again and again in his stories, and then one is his very first story was radical in that it starts with not a Pinkerton op, but an operative for a fictional agency on a river in Burma, and he's been chasing this thief for, I don't know if it's 2 or 3 years, since they were both in New York. And it opens with him. He's cornered his man, and you know, in the contemporary stories of the time, you know, he would be totally admirable, and he would get his man and bring him back. And instead, the story ends with him being offered this bribe. If you come into the jungle with me, I will share my stolen ruby collection with you. And it ends with him thinking it over. And that's the end of the story. And this I found, Hammett himself was once trailing a guy named Finsterwald from one state to another, who was accused of stealing jewels, and finally the guy came up to him on a park bench where Hammett thought he was discreetly watching him in the park, and said, "Don't you look familiar? Do I know you from somewhere?" And it was because he'd been following him from state to state, and so of course he was familiar. And they got to talking, and the guy started to offer him part of his scam. And Hammett then turned him in, and then he was arrested when he arrived where he was going. That's not as dramatic as what he made of it in his first story, but you see it throughout his other stories, where a woman will come up and try to seduce the detective, who throws her over, and then he perfected it until the Maltese Falcon has the most famous example. And in there, it's loyalty to his dead partner that gives him the strength to turn down the offer. But I think there's events like that he would just then refashion, and each time it wasn't perfect, and he would do it again. He had a lot of themes that he would return to until he had gotten it right. Whereas other people would be afraid they were repeating themselves, he was sort of like perfecting it.
Yeah, and I guess you make the case too that some of the detectives that he worked with, and even some of the bosses he worked for, ended up in some of his short stories as, I guess, they inspired characters in the stories. I guess the one I'm thinking about is the old man, right, in his Continental Op series.
Yes, the old man, again, in the other biographical works, there's this assumption that the old man was based on Phil Giak, who had been his supervisor in San Francisco. But when I looked into Phil Giak's actual biography and description, he was like 40 years old and short and fat, more like the Continental Op. And but Hammett had said that at some dinner, and so people just believed it. I think that the old man, who was described as having white mustache and being a glowering older figure in his 70s, much more resembled the most famous Pinkerton of all, who wasn't an actual Pinkerton family member, McParland, James McParland, who was the operative who cracked the Molly Maguire ring.
Gotcha. All right, so Hammett broke, he cut his teeth writing with these pulp fiction magazines. And like I said, it's often forgotten part of American literary history. I mean, what sort of stuff would people find in the pulps? I mean, what kind of stories, besides the detective stuff? I mean, was it just sort of lowbrow?
Well, originally, they did everything. You know, they'd have horror, they'd have, weird tales, they'd have sort of erotica, not like erotica now, but what they called, there was a magazine called Saucy Tales, things like that, and westerns were big. And Hammett loved Westerns, and there's a certain critical school that sees the detective story as just the Western come into the urban setting. And there's, you know, there's something to that. Which is why he would play jokes on that, like when he has one where the Continental Op leaves San Francisco and he goes to Arizona and he has to ride a horse around, and there's a rustling gang and everything, and he can't ride the horse. And, you know, he would make fun of the genres he was writing about at the same time. That's one of the great misunderstood things about him, is, you know, how funny he is. And it's, you know, it's okay to send up the thing that you are also participating in at the same time. And I think that makes some people uncomfortable. Like, is this serious or not? He's like making fun of it at the same time. And he's just, you know, he was always amusing himself. His work is full of in-jokes to himself, just to amuse himself. Starting with the Continental Agency, which is his mythical version of the Pinkerton Agency, because he first worked in the Continental Building in Baltimore. That's where the Pinkertons were.
Gotcha. Yeah, you can really see his humor shine through in The Thin Man, I think.
Yes.
It's hilarious. The back and forth dialogue is amazing in that book.
Especially that one. And that's where he sort of had, he's sort of given up on the classic detective novel by then. It's hard to describe, but you know, the protagonist is an ex-detective, the writer is an ex-detective, and he's out of his element. But you know, he's just there to have a good time, and his wife keeps telling him to go back to what he used to do to solve the crime. It's a funny self-referential thing.
So let's talk about Sam Spade, because this is the most iconic character of Dashiell Hammett, thanks to Humphrey Bogart. Where did Sam Spade come from? Did his Pinkerton experience have any influence on the creation of Sam Spade?
I really don't think so. I think Sam Spade is, as he said, he's a dream man. He's what all the guys he used to work with wished they could be, or thought they sometimes were. That's how he described it. The thing about Sam Spade, in Pinkerton terms, you can see him as the absolute product of assimilation. I mean, he's so assimilated with criminals that you really don't know what he's going to do. Like, is he crooked, or is he pretending to be crooked? You know, that's how he plays both sides to do his job, is that he's absolutely unpredictable except for his loyalty to the client. No matter how scummy, he'll still take their money and give it his all, but you don't know what he really thinks about anything, except when he's pushed to it. As he says, when a man's partner is killed, he's supposed to do something about it. So there's the buddy element in the end, but this is the same guy who was sleeping with his partner's wife while he was alive. So you know, he's not like your best friend, but he does have a point. He does have an outer limit.
Yeah.
So he's, and because he's so unpredictable, I just think he seems more lifelike than all the copycat detectives that he inspired. There's something about Sam Spade he's so alive on the page in the way that nothing Mickey Spillane ever did, is the same. It's just, he's mercurial, but he's fascinating, and he has no history. There's no, you know, you don't find out about his childhood. You don't know there's no inner monologues, and yet everybody has an idea of what Sam Spade is about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the only thing we do know that that inspired Sam Spade, or is part of the character of Sam Spade, is Sam Spade's apartment. I thought this was really interesting. So,
oh yeah, that's right.
Can you
talk
a little bit about Sam Spade's apartment as Dashiell Hammett's apartment?
Well, when he wrote that book and Red Harvest, he was living in basically a 500 square foot studio on Post Street, which is still there in San Francisco, and he had originally ended up there because he'd have these flare-ups of his tuberculosis, and the doctors said he had to live apart from his young children because it's, you know, it's unhealthful. And so he moved around San Francisco, and sometimes he would come back, and he was living in this little apartment, writing his brains out. I mean, it actually allowed him to write the novels that he finally wrote. To me, the most moving part of writing this was there's this famous part of the book. It's known as the Flitcraft Parable. I mean, he didn't call it that, but that's what people call it, in which Sam Spade tells this story about a man named Flitcraft who was on his lunch hour one day and a beam fell and just missed killing him. It hit the sidewalk next to him and like a piece of cement hit his cheek. And he was so unnerved by this that he had to abandon his life as it was. And he left his wife and his child, and went relocated to another town where he started up exactly the same kind of life. So the point of the story is, as Spade tells it, he adjusted to beams falling, and then he adjusted to them no longer falling in his new life. And then Spade is hired to go find him by Mrs. Flitcraft, and he does, but he leaves him alone, rather than bring him back, which you think would be the Spade-like thing to do. He's like, he's the bulldog. If you're hired to go retrieve somebody for you know, and why doesn't he bring him back? And I've always thought that was strange. Until I realized at that moment that Hammett was writing it, he was living apart from his family, and he was contemplating leaving San Francisco altogether and going to New York. His book was going to come out, and he was going to get some more movie money, and to start his life apart from them. And the Flitcraft Parable is Hammett really talking to himself about this decision. And I just found that very moving, because you know, when you read these books about an artist, you are supposed to root at every point for them to move through their life to the part where they become the great artist that you got interested in the first place. And at this point, as a father and a writer, I felt some of the uneasiness that he must have felt. You know, he really made a choice, and what he did was he moved his wife and his daughters to Hollywood, where they were supposed to just wait for him to become a success in Hollywood and come back and live with them. Well, he never lived with them, but he did visit them there, and he did take care of them. But he lived the life that you associate with him ever since, you know, the Lillian Hellman life and the going to parties and hanging around in Hollywood and drinking too much.
Yeah.
That's where that started.
Yeah. He basically did the whole F. Scott Fitzgerald thing, just write movies and drink a lot.
Yes.
So
but I think, unlike Scott Fitzgerald, I think in Hammett's case, he had come so close to death with tuberculosis that I really don't think he expected to live very long. I mean, maybe, years, but not like years and years. And so the miscalculation he made was that he would live as long as he did. You know, that's the mystery is always, oh, why did he stop writing? Which actually he stopped publishing, but he didn't stop writing. I really think he thought he could, you know, he could still go at any time.
Yeah. So what's, we've talked about Hammett and his days at Pinkerton and how it influenced his career, but what's Hammett's legacy today? I mean, what authors did he influence, and where can we see the fingerprints of Hammett's and of Hammett's in pop culture right now?
Well, I mean, I think he's in most cop shows, what he started with the giving all the procedural background stuff. You know, then we drove over to here. Then we watched their house for a while. Then we followed her into the supermarket. Things that before him would have been thought to be dull and no one wants to read that. They just want a nice murder mystery set in an estate, you know, and you round up the swells who were at the house that weekend, and one of them must have been the killer. And what he did was, with his early op stories, which were, you know, they were like making literature out of the op reports that he had written before. I mean, it's the same format of following the detective around and making literature out of the tedium of investigation. And so once he introduced that, then it became like a competitive sport, like who would have the most authentic background. And so then by the 40s, you have detective movies where they're talking about the skeleton of the corpse. And obviously, she was less than 24 years old because look at the development of the femur and, you know, that kind of stuff. And that, all the way to CSI. I mean, I think that's he started that procedural form. And then, or look at something like Bone. Is it, what's the show with it? Well, any show where there's a man and a woman like flirting on the crime scene, solving crimes, it's all from The Thin Man.
Yeah.
You know, McMillan and Wife or Castle.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, that's another trope of his. I don't know that he'd love all those shows, but I think you can definitely trace it directly to him. True Detective would be unthinkable without him. I don't think he would have liked this season, but the first season. I don't know. And he's certainly in Michael Connelly, Dennis Lennon. You know, he's in a lot of stuff out there now.
Yeah. Well, cool. Hey, well, Nathan.
People mix him up with Chandler, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
Chandler was his biggest fan, and they don't write the same. I think where it goes down, what it, back to is Humphrey Bogart playing both their heroes.
Yeah.
And so people mix them up because Humphrey Bogart played both. The same way people mix up Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone because Fess Parker played them both. You know, they haven't always read the books, so they rely on the movies. I've also noticed that when The Maltese Falcon was chosen by the Wall Street Journal as like the book of the month for online discussions, it was clobbered for Sam's sexism, which is like, you know, I don't know what they were expecting to read, but I just couldn't imagine people having the same reaction with an old movie. There's somehow people are smarter now about film than they are about old novels, which is, I think, sad. But I couldn't imagine people saying the same things about the film of the book.
Yeah,
that's just my impression.
Interesting.
I think he also invented what we call noir with The Maltese Falcon. That whole it's removed, and then he zooms in on the ashtray on Sam's desk, and then Sam rolls another cigarette, and then it's so atmospheric. In a way that movies would not be for another 10 years. Then, you know, because the film The Maltese Falcon was in 1941, and you know, he wrote that in 1929. But, the, you know, all the noir stuff in film was years after what the writers were doing in The Black Mask and The Pulps and True Detective magazine. It took that much longer for the movie audience to be wised up by the Depression and World War II to want that kind of film. I don't know. I mean, I can't really explain. I'm not a cinema person, but I definitely see what became film noir in The Maltese Falcon, and not really before that.
Well, fascinating. Well, hey,
the book, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Nathan Ward, this has been a fascinating conversation. Where can people learn more about the book? Just Amazon?
Amazon's good. Bloomsbury. You mean where else can I buy it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazon's as good as any. Yeah.
All right. Well, Nathan Ward, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you.
My guest today was Nathan Ward. He's the author of the book, The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett or Dashiell Hammett. And you can find that on Amazon.com or bookstores everywhere. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, as always, I'd really appreciate it if you take the time to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Help us give us some feedback on how we can improve the show, as well as let the other people know about the podcast. And as always, thank you for your continued support of the podcast. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.